When Typhoon Haiyan struck the Philippines, it took the world little time to realize the devastation that was unfolding. This week, national agencies are reporting a death toll of more than 5,000, with perhaps 1,600 more missing. 13,000 were injured, and as many as 3 million people have been displaced. What took even less time was for the first calls for donations by toll-free number and email, by text and television. The appeals started quickly and continue still. But how do you know that your desire to help is really helping, that your giving is actually doing good and not harm? Good morning. Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. We're approaching the time of year when people tend to be most generous. Today, we take a look at how the best of intentions can sometimes backfire and how to make sure that doesn't happen to you. Later, we'll be joined by a local expert on not-for-profit work around here. But first, we're joined by Amy Costello. She's been a producer and reporter for various public radio and television programs, including 5 years as Africa reporter for The World. She's now also host and producer of her own podcast, Tiny Spark, and she joins us from Austin, Texas. Amy, good morning. Wait, let's try that again on the phones. Amy Costello, good morning to you.
Good morning, Brian.
There you are. Well, thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk for a minute about you, actually. How did you find yourself a reporter on this particular beat? What can go wrong with charitable giving?
Well, as you said, you know, I reported in Africa for many years for the public radio program The World and did a little bit of public television reporting as well. And I came to discover kind of over the course of that time how difficult it is to implement good ideas and well-intentioned projects in remote parts of the world, in places where it's difficult to, you know, access people, where there's dirt roads, where there's very little communication. And I saw lots of well-intentioned people and programs that were trying to do good. And I discovered in the course of my reporting that it's actually really hard to do that. And I can give you a specific example about the play pump technology, if you'd like.
Yeah, please. That's sort of the main example that kind of got you on this track, right?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was reporting in Africa, I did a story first for radio and then for television about a technology called the play pump. And there was this amazing, very dynamic social entrepreneur behind the technology who was saying to me that you can put a kind of basically kind of a merry-go-round into the ground. Children begin to push that device round and round. They're getting to play as they spin and spin. And as they spin, clean drinking water is pumped from beneath the ground and stored into a tank above them.
And sounds great.
It sounded awesome. And, you know, visually it was beautiful. The kids were smiling. They were getting a chance to play. Mothers no longer had to use the difficult hand pump to pump their water. They could just go over to a tap, and clean drinking water would pour out. And so I did a very positive radio story about it. I did a very positive television story for it for the public television program Frontline World. Huge response from donors. Bill Clinton and Laura Bush got behind the initiative, threw many more millions of dollars at the technology. And I was told at the time that my story was a big part of the reason that they were able to raise so much money for the technology.
Wow,
I thought this was a fabulous thing. I thought, great, more money. This is wonderful. You know, more play pumps going in the ground for children and families in Africa. Well, I followed up a few years later and found out that basically everything that could have gone wrong with the technology had gone wrong, from financial malfeasance to communities rejecting the technology to them not being maintained. And I had to, at that point, take a really hard look at myself, at my reporting, and realize that I have a responsibility as a reporter to really dig deep with well-intentioned people and projects because they can, in fact, do harm if they're not executed properly. And I discovered that when I went out to follow up on this story. I met with women and communities who had been without clean drinking water for months and months because their play pump had broken down and had not been replaced. And I felt partially responsible for that. And so that was kind of the genesis of Tiny Spark, to start taking a more critical and comprehensive look at good ideas to see, are they having the effect that we think they're having? And it's important for me to say this. I don't do it because I want to discourage people from trying to do good. I do it because I think very much that we should be trying to do good with our donor dollars. I think we should be using our skills to help others. But I want to make sure we're doing it as effectively and having as much impact as possible.
Now, let me come back to the play pump story for a minute. Aren't you being a little hard on yourself? I mean, how would you have known that that was going to go badly?
Well, you know, in retrospect, yes. I mean, I think on one level it was just kind of a short profile piece of the social entrepreneur and his wonderful idea. But, you know, in reporting the follow-up story, I did talk to water people, people who are very much involved with water and sanitation, people who are involved with kind of how these mechanisms actually work from kind of a hardware standpoint. And there were people who were skeptical of the technology from the beginning. And, you know, I don't think I'm being too hard on myself. If I, you know, at the time, I had no indication that this was anything but a positive technology, and I certainly believed at the time, rather naively, that more money is always better. So if the play pump could have $5 million, great, but if they could have $10 or $15 million, all the better is what I thought. And I've learned since that time that more donor dollars pushed toward a technology is not necessarily a good thing if that organization is unprepared to handle that influx of money and spend it and utilize it in an effective and efficient way with buy-in from the communities that they're trying to help.
Well, I want to talk about some of the other examples of situations you have covered where this sort of problem has been discovered. But let's talk a little bit about Tiny Spark. What is Tiny Spark now, anyway?
Tiny Spark is a podcast and public radio program that investigates the business of doing good. And so, you know, there are, as many of your listeners probably know, there's lots of podcasts out there these days and podcasters doing all kinds of programming. And I think that one thing that makes what I'm doing unique is that my investigations are taking months to do. I'm doing a lot of shoe leather reporting, going out into the field, you know, twice now recently to Africa to follow up on well-intentioned programs to see with my own eyes how they're panning out for the people on the ground. Because I, you know, one of the most important things that I'm doing with Tiny Spark is following up. Because I think a lot of times we hear about these great ideas, we hear about these social entrepreneurs, we hear about our donor dollars going places. But who really follows up 5-10 years later to say, well, you know, what happened to all that money? Or did that really great initiative pan out in the end for the people that it was supposed to help? Did it do harm? And so these are the kinds of questions that interest me. And so I've had a few partners along the way. The Chronicle of Philanthropy, a very well-regarded publication in the philanthropic sector, funded my first few podcasts. I then joined in a partnership with The World, the program that I used to follow for from Africa, and I'm producing a series with them in conjunction with Tiny Spark called Tracking Charity, in which we're doing a global investigative series, you know, which is kind of self-explanatory. We're literally tracking charity. We're literally tracking down good ideas and seeing what became of them. And, you know, going forward, my plan is to continue to do investigative reporting on the business of doing good. And I'm happy to say that just this morning I successfully funded my Kickstarter campaign, and part of the proceeds I'll be using with that is to assign two other investigative reporters to do stories, because my hope is to really grow this. I'm only one person so far. I'm the one who's produced all of the content, but I'd love to get some other really good investigative reporters out there on this beat to help me cover it more thoroughly.
Well, one of the early reports you did as part of that Tracking Charity series that aired on PRI's The World was about malaria and treatment to avoid malaria, the distribution of bed nets that perhaps a lot of people have heard about. I want to listen to just a little bit of the beginning of your report. We'll come back to you in a moment to tell us what actually happened, but here's where you're setting the stage about the problem of malaria that afflicts many villages in Africa, and specifically here in Malawi.
You can see the grip malaria has over parts of Africa when you visit a village like Chikwawa in southern Malawi. Look just beyond the brick huts and goats, and you see a big lake. It's filled with fish, a source of food for the residents here, but the lake's also a breeding ground for mosquitoes that spread disease. Some mothers and children sit in the shade waiting to speak to me. Among them, there's a 10-year-old girl. She's lying on a mat, listless. They tell me her fever, vomiting, and lack of energy mean malaria. I turn to the girl's mother. When is the last time your child had malaria before this time?
1 month.
So she had malaria 1 month ago?
Mm.
The other moms have similar stories. This one says her child had malaria last month, too. Another woman says she has malaria now. The disease is incredibly common here, despite a multi-billion-dollar effort to defeat it across Africa. The fight against malaria has largely centered on battling the mosquitoes that transmit the illness. There have been attempts to use larvicide to kill baby mosquitoes, campaigns to spray the walls of people's homes with insecticides, and bed nets have been given out to African families to protect them when they're sleeping and most prone to getting bitten.
That's Amy Costello reporting there for PRI's The World. That story aired back in July. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison, and we're talking today about charitable giving when the best of intentions sometimes backfire. Amy Costello, you go on in that story to talk about what happened with those bed nets that so many organizations have worked to distribute there.
Yeah, there were lots of problems with the way that multi-billion dollar campaign was rolled out. From the outset, it's very important for everyone to understand that insecticide-treated bed nets remain a very important intervention in preventing malaria. However, there are significant challenges ahead for the program, and ones that, in my reporting, I discovered may have been avoidable. You know, I'll point to two big problems with this campaign. The first was that these insecticide-treated bed nets are things that, you know, nets that children and families are supposed to sleep under because they get bit by mosquitoes, and mosquitoes carry malaria, which can be a deadly disease and is a deadly disease in many parts of Africa and other parts of the world today. And so these nets were given out to families across Africa, all treated with one class of insecticides. And what happens when you roll out a technology using just one insecticide everywhere is that resistance emerges. Mosquitoes will eventually become resistant to the insecticide you've put on that net, and therefore the effectiveness of that net will become greatly reduced. And the problem is right now there exists no other insecticide to replace, to put on those nets now. And so there is resistance emerging, and that is causing big problems because the nets are becoming less effective. And the other thing that I discovered is that the nets aren't lasting. They're marketed as an intervention that will last anywhere from 3 to 5 years. However, I met plenty of families where I visited in Malawi where their nets were lasting for less than a year. And you can see on the World's website or on the Tiny Spark website my photographs that show women holding up nets with huge gaping holes in them. And the malaria expert I spoke to, one of the most respected in the world, said that in light of insecticide resistance, if people are sleeping with holes in their nets in areas that are resistant to insecticides, that net is really as good as nothing. And if it's replaced with a new net with the same insecticide, that's not going to be very helpful either. So a couple of big significant problems with the way that campaign was rolled out. And unfortunately, the lives of many, many children across Africa are now at risk because of it.
Yeah, it's striking that so many people have donated to that campaign and have thought, I have actually saved lives. I have done something important by providing bed nets for families in Africa, when in fact it could be that their money is going for nothing.
Well, absolutely. And again, you know, as I said when I started talking about this, it's very important, and I think anybody involved with malaria, fighting malaria around the world would say that they remain an important intervention. And nobody's saying that families should no longer sleep under nets. It's vitally important that they sleep under nets. It's vitally important that they have no holes in their net. But yes, the marketing for the technology has been very simplistic. And there are, in fact, organizations out there that say, buy a net, save a life. But it's much more complicated than that. And you know, it's one thing to donate and to give a net to a family, but are they using it? Are they using it properly? Mm-hmm. Does their net have holes in it? Is there resistance in this area? So like so many kind of good ideas, what I find more and more is that, you know, there's simplistic marketing messages, but the reality is often much more complicated than that. And I think it's important for all of us to understand that buying a net can be good, but there's lots of other things that need to fall into place in order to make that net truly effective.
Well, let's invite our listeners to the conversation. Want to know where you've seen good intentions to help go astray. When have you found yourself wanting to give but unsure that it was really serving the purpose you intended? And what do you do to make sure that your giving is going for good? Give us a call here at Central Standard, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us your questions or comments to centralstandard@kcur.org. Amy Costello, you've also done some reporting about activity in Haiti following the devastating earthquake there. You know, these examples of the bed nets and the play pumps, these were cases where the equipment, one way or another, turns out to be faulty or doesn't solve the problem. But in Haiti, it was a different problem. It had to do with the kinds of skills that ended up traveling to be there in the immediate aftermath of the earthquake, right?
Yeah, that's right, Brian. I did an investigation about the many, many medical volunteers who went to Haiti in the days and weeks following their devastating earthquake. And I think partly due to the United States' proximity to Haiti, there were many, many people, including surgeons, nurses, doctors, all kinds of people who flew down there to try and help. But what I discovered is that many of them actually caused harm to patients because they didn't have adequate training. There's a belief or a conception among many, I think, kind of lay people, but also people in the medical community in America and other, kind of Western nations that, hey, if I know how to provide surgery at New York or in California, I can certainly do it in Haiti. But in fact, everybody who's involved with kind of post-crisis international emergency medicine says you must have specialized training before you go to a place like Haiti or the Philippines or any other natural disaster of this kind of magnitude. Because one example that happened is that many surgeons arrived in Haiti without their own anesthesia. They assumed that anesthesia would be provided for them.
They thought they would just be walking into an operating room like they would in the United States.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, in many instances, there was no anesthesia available. And so what happened was two things, both of them awful. Either the surgeons waited days and days for anesthesia to arrive, and in the meantime, very critically ill and injured patients continued to suffer and decline and sometimes died while surgeons awaited anesthesia. Or, according to reports, other surgeons went ahead and performed surgery without anesthesia.
Oh, my.
Which is obviously terrible and avoidable. And so, you know, the good news in this story, however, is this, is that it's very easy for anyone with a medical background who is interested in volunteering post-crisis doing international emergency medicine, they can get training sometimes over the course of just a weekend that tells them all the things they need to know before they go down to a situation and try to start practicing medicine down there. There were interventions done on patients that were very sophisticated and appropriate in a high-resource setting in a, you know, an American hospital, but in a very low-resource situation like Haiti after the earthquake, where there was basically nothing available for post-follow-up care, doctors, nurses, and surgeons came in and gave the kind of care they would give in the U.S. and then left, leaving kind of no follow-up plan for these patients. And many of them were left with sophisticated medical devices in their legs and broken limbs that then became infected, and there was no one there to treat them. So that's the other problem with international emergency medicine in the wake of a crisis, is that there's no kind of coordinating body that organizes all the volunteers. You don't even have to register to go to a post-crisis situation and start practicing medicine. I spoke to one very seasoned surgeon who said he went to Haiti 5 times and no one ever asked to see his credentials.
Wow. So no accountability. No one can be reported for their poor performance either.
Definitely. And I spent months reporting this story, and I was amazed by the lack of paperwork involved. And other studies that have looked at the medical response in Haiti have said the same thing. Historically, there's very little paperwork generated by the volunteers who go there. So trying to analyze and synthesize the type of care that was given and what the outcomes were is nearly impossible to do. Now, of course, people will say, well, they're just trying to save lives. It's an emergency. Yes, that's true. But that doesn't mean that we can't set up systems that will generate the kind of paperwork and data that we need so that we can learn from these responses. And we can say, how do we do better next time? What didn't go right? What went well? You know, what worked? And so there's a real lack of data, a lack of coordination with these kinds of situations. And, you know, but again, great room for improvement. There's lots of opportunities here to do better.
816-235-2888 is the number to participate in the conversation. What questions do you have for Amy Costello? 816-235-2888. Let's talk with O'Day in Overland Park. Good morning, O'Day.
Hi. I'm just wondering if, I love everything I'm hearing, but I do also work with the low-income community here within our borders, and I think that some CASAs might be able to use some of that, you know, insight that follows up logistically post, launching of the program. And I'm wondering if she's also doing that within her borders.
Yeah, that's a great question, O'Day. Thanks for calling. Beyond Africa, beyond Haiti and international relief, have you done research on American charities and similar situations where good intentions don't always pan out, Amy?
Yes. I would love to do more of that. I mean, I'm very interested in doing domestic stories and following up on them. And I hope in the year ahead to do some of that. Lots of the stories that I've done overseas definitely involve U.S. organizations and charities and kind of following where U.S. donor dollars are going around the world. But I absolutely agree with your listener who says that, you know, there's lots of need for us to really look critically and closely at initiatives in our own communities. And, one thing that I really rely on is our tips from listeners. So, to the extent that anyone has firsthand experience with a domestic organization, one that's working in your community that you have questions about, I'd be happy to hear about it and potentially look into it for a story. So, yeah, I mean, that's why I'm looking to kind of bring a few other reporters on board with me, because it's a $1 trillion, more than a $1 trillion industry, kind of the doing good nonprofit sector. So it's just enormous. There's so little oversight. There's so many potential stories to do. But right now I'm just one person, so I am a little limited in what I can do. But I absolutely have my eyes on some domestic stories.
We should mention again that Amy Costello's website is tinyspark.org if you want to get in touch with her there. Let's talk to Jim in Parkville. Jim, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Good. I worked with an NGO, and the initial plan was to go in and try to help provide clean drinking water to a community that they had already been working with, so they had an established relationship. And they went to the extent of putting in a pretty elaborate filtration system in a church and thought everything was going to work just fine, and they left the country, and then they came back 6 months later, and the person was trying to extort money for the water, and they weren't maintaining the system properly, so it ended up being basically a waste. So they came up with another way of doing it by providing the filtration system in the home and giving those to the mothers in the homes, and those mothers became water women, and the water women were able to control it, so there was no problem with them. And then the water women were also encouraged to share their water with other people, which they did gratefully.
Mm-hmm. Jim, thanks for telling us about a situation where it maybe didn't work and then where it did.
Yes, you're welcome.
Appreciate it. Amy, is that pretty typical, that it sometimes takes a little while to figure out how to make a project work correctly?
Absolutely. It sounds like in many ways a great outcome for some initial challenges that were faced. And I think that, that's one thing that so many initiatives learn along the way, is how important it is to have buy-in from the community, to have them involved from day one, that this is in fact a genuine partnership, not me coming in from the West trying to help you and tell you what you need according to my perspective. It's about both of us working together, both of us identifying challenges together to say, what are your needs? What's most important to you? You need clean drinking water? Well, how about if we did this? Well, if you did this, people might start to charge for it. Some of these things could be avoided up front by clear communication and buy-in with the community. But the point is, lessons are learned, and it's great when you can kind of then pivot and say, okay, let's do it this way based on what we've learned. And one thing reporting on this sector that's one of the biggest challenges is getting nonprofits, charitable groups, well-intentioned people to be forthcoming and transparent about their failures. There is a culture in the nonprofit sector, in my opinion, and it's changing a little bit, which I'm glad to see, but there's a lot of reluctance to be transparent with donors and the general public about things that haven't worked, things that have, you know, failed. And the unfortunate part of that is then we don't learn. Mm. And so a lot of when projects fail, we often don't hear about them. And that's really a missed opportunity for us to all kind of analyze the situation and figure out how can we go forward more effectively. So that's really what I'm trying to do, and trying to get organizations and nonprofits to be transparent about their failures.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. Let's take one more call before the break. Richard in Odessa, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I got a question for Amy. I know that she was talking about these doctors that were kind of ill-prepared, but I can take this answer off the air. Isn't it better to have these doctors that come, even though they don't have any anesthesia and they have to wait for days, than to let the patients, the patients may get worse, but at least they're going to get medical care. Rather, if you don't have these doctors show up because they're not trained in this type of situation, and then not getting any care at all, how many more people would die? How many more people would die a very painful death? And I just give me this off the air. I'd appreciate it, and thank you.
Thank you, Richard. You know, it's a good question, Amy. Isn't some help better than the best than no help? If you, even if it's not perfect.
It is a great question, and resoundingly, the answer I hear from experienced people is no. Some help is not necessarily better than no help at all. And every kind of seasoned medical person I spoke to who works in disaster areas post-crisis said to me, it's better if you don't have training to stay home. Because, you know, harm can be caused because you can be taking up resources that could be better allocated to survivors themselves. And yes, I mean, I think what your listener says is true. You could do some good if you just sit around waiting for the anesthesia to arrive. But everybody I spoke to said better if you don't have the training to stay home.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll ask what to do about all this then. How do you know whether your time or your money will be well spent on a particular cause or supporting a particular organization? We will talk with one local expert, and we'll continue our conversation with Amy Costello of Tiny Spark. You can call us at 816-235-2888. You can also write to us on Twitter. You can tweet at KCURCST. Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Today, we're talking about one way people show gratitude for what they have, charitable giving of their resources or time, and the ways that doesn't always work out as planned. Sometimes resources are wasted or squandered or do more harm than good. Amy Costello of TinySpark.org is with us, and we're also joined now by one local expert on charitable giving. Denise St. Omer is Vice President of Community Investment at the Greater Kansas City Community Foundation. Welcome to you, Denise.
Thank you. Good morning.
It's great to have you here. So remind our listeners what the Greater Kansas City Community Foundation is and what you do.
The Greater Kansas City Community Foundation is a way for donors to maximize their giving through the use of what we call charitable giving accounts or donor advised funds. So it makes giving efficient and convenient.
And that means that you do some screening of the various causes that folks giving might go to.
We do. So when an individual makes opens up a charitable giving account with the Community Foundation, they can recommend where they want those grants to go. So there is due diligence that's done on the part of the Community Foundation.
Now, obviously, folks sometimes give through the foundation, sometimes they give on their own to other organizations. If someone asks you how they should decide what to support, what they should give to, obviously you don't tell them what organizations to give to, but how do you think they should go about making that decision?
Well, I think that's correct. The Community Foundation, we do not tell people, because we know that most of our donors know what they care about and are passionate about. But what we try to do is we try to provide our donors with easy access to information that can help them do some checking and make sure that what they want to accomplish with their charitable giving ties in. And so to do that, we have on our website at gkccf.org, you can click on Nonprofit Search. And that's a voluntary database of over 600 local nonprofits, and it contains very detailed information that they're providing voluntarily. So financial information, information about their governance, their programs, and how they measure that the results that they're achieving for the clients they're serving.
So what are the kinds of information that you think would be important for someone to look at, even if they do go to that database? There's lots of information there. What do you think is most relevant to consider?
Well, I think probably the first thing that I think most individuals will want to look at is the financial health of the organization. I encourage people to think of charitable giving as charitable investing. So you want to, just like when you are investing your dollars, you want to make sure that you're going to be able to get the returns you need or that you're looking for. It's the same with your giving. So financial health, I think, is important. You want to make sure that if you give a gift to an organization, that they're going to be around long enough to actually do their programming.
You know, when you speak of it as investment, I think of return on investment. And I have to think, though, with certain kinds of not-for-profit work, that's a very difficult thing to measure. If a group does education, or if a group, and I should fully disclose that I'm executive director of a nonprofit, and I think, well, gosh, how would I measure that? How would I show someone data? It's not like building pumps in Africa. It's more complicated than that. How do you answer those questions, like, about return on investment?
Well, and I think that's a really good question. And I think what you have to do as a donor is you have to say to yourself, what is it that I want to accomplish with my giving? And then when you look at what an organization is saying or the results that they are going to achieve. So the nonprofit, they're going to tell you, and they should be, you should expect every nonprofit is establishing outcomes for their programs. So you want to look at what those outcomes are. You want to see if they are realistic and if they're measurable and if the organization has the tools in place to measure their outcomes.
Let me invite Amy Costello to jump in as well. You know about websites and sources of data that people can check as well. What criteria do you encourage folks to check out as they are considering where to give?
Yeah, there's two kind of national organizations that I think are doing some pretty good work kind of independently evaluating charities. One of them is called GiveWell, and that organization is kind of a young upstart organization. It's only been around, don't quote me on this, but I think like a couple of years, maybe a little bit more than that. And what they do is they kind of put forward a handful of organizations that they think are doing really good work, and they rigorously analyze the outcomes, rigorously analyze the data themselves to come to this conclusion. What they're not going to do is say, we think all these other charities are terrible. They don't kind of rank them in that way. All they do is provide to you a handful of organizations that they think are doing excellent work. So I think they're GiveWell. I think it's givewell.org is a good place to start, as well as the more comprehensive Charity Navigator that profiles a great many more national organizations and also kind of rates them on a number of criteria. And I think what Denise has said is very important and useful. I think where we kind of might come at odds is, and what I'm trying to do with Tiny Spark, is to kind of dig behind the data that organizations provide, because it's one thing to provide financials, to provide, what we think are, what established outcomes we've put forward, but are those things accurate? Even if they're accurate to the best of the knowledge of the organization, it's very hard to know, especially if they're doing work far away from home base, whether they're actually having the impact that they think they're having with their. And, if your organizations that you're profiling are doing local work, that's much easier for potential donors to follow up on, of course. They can just walk into the organization. They can go meet with the recipients of the aid to see for themselves with their own eyes what kind of impact those organizations are having.
Harder to do with African charities.
Yeah, definitely.
Denise St. Omer, is that a fair critique? I mean, you do rely mostly on information that the organizations provide for themselves.
Well, I do think that is true. We are, but I think when you're, the financial information we're looking at is their 990, and if they have audited financials, we are looking at that. I think that what is something that we also offer to our donors, and primarily through the larger foundations that we provide, organized, that we do run their organized grant making for, is we do, as Amy said, also have the ability to have staff go and actually visit the organizations to do site visits and to follow up on that due diligence and to also require some reporting both programmatically and fiscally that will come back on those larger grants.
Let's talk to
and
our
–
go ahead, Amy.
I just wanted to know, so if people go out and find things that are remiss, they find things in the field that aren't working as promoted, do you share that publicly?
We do not have the ability on our website to put that information out there. But what we do have the ability to do for, and we have done in the past for individual donors that have asked us or have had concerns with a grant that they've made, to be able to go out and follow up on that information and share that with the donor.
That's Denise St. Omer. She's Vice President of Community Investment at the Greater Kansas City Community Foundation. Also talking with Amy Costello, host, producer, reporter with tinyspark.org. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking about charitable giving. As you consider your own giving this year, what questions do you have? You can ask the experts here. What do you need to know? Give us a call at 816-235-2888, 235-2888. Heather in Independence, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
Well, thanks for waiting.
Certainly. I was just going to make a comment that I have found myself becoming much more vigilant about where I'm putting my money. I would donate $25 or $50 to somewhere, and then over the course of the next year, I would end up with 5,000 labels and, you know, all these mailers that I know that cost way more than my $25. And so I became much more interested in finding out how much overhead a company spends for marketing and those types of things, and the internet provides a lot of resources for that. And also I kind of went to just donating my time, which to me is worth a lot of money, depending on what you get paid, and it actually makes me feel a lot better to local organizations. I can't do that nationally sometimes, but I just wanted to know if I know that people feel that way when you donate something, it feels like you get more back. I was just wondering if there were any comments about that.
Yeah,
thank you so much. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
And you too, Heather. Thanks. Thanks for the call. Denise, if you donate $25 and then you think they spend $50 on postage to you in mailings, what do you make of that?
Well, and I do think that is one of the areas that I refer to when I talk about really looking at an organization's kind of financial information and fiscal health. And to do that, when you do that, and particularly for those that are on the nonprofits that are on our website, what you can see is what percentage of their overall revenues go to administrative costs versus direct programming. So when you, and I think that can be a red flag for you when you see, you know, as a general rule, you want to not see more than 25% of an organization's overall revenue going to administrative costs. It can go up to 35 depending on the type of services they're providing. But when you start to see that getting higher, or a large percentage of their operating budget going to fundraising, I think that is good information for a donor to use in deciding whether that's a charity they want to support.
Yeah, Amy Costello, when you look at those numbers of organizations, is there a certain number that's too high? Is there a certain percentage, a certain salary for executives that you think is just unjustifiable?
No, primarily because I don't like to be beholden to numbers, and I also feel that's a little outside of my realm of expertise, and I think there's lots of people who have very strong opinions about nonprofit salaries and what's appropriate and what isn't, and that's an issue I kind of choose not to weigh in on myself, at least I'm not at this stage. But on that point, I think, and going on Denise's point too, I think, and going on your caller's point, a really empowering thing for potential donors to do is also go to a website called GuideStar, because there you can look at yourself with your own eyes the tax returns of every registered nonprofit in the United States. It's called their Form 990s. And anybody who's filed a tax return themselves can kind of easily make your way through it. It's not too overwhelming, but if there's specific questions you want to see, how much have they spent on advertising, how much are their executives being paid, lots of really useful information can be gleaned from those, and it's all free. It's all available on the web just by going to GuideStar. So that's one place I'd point people to.
Let's talk to Jane in Warrensburg. She called us at 816-235-2888. Jane, welcome to Central Standard.
Hello. I want to say thank you to your guests and to you for having this topic up today, because it has been on my mind. And I appreciated Heather's question, too. But I tend to be generous and cynical. So right now in our little town, there is a group that is a not-for-profit group who are attempting to complete a project, and it's a cause that I support. I like, however, one, to give anonymously, and I want to be sure, as we've been having this conversation this morning, that I'm making an investment. So I went to the group's website, and there's essentially nothing there. And I do trust the group that originated the concept, that they handed it off to this other nonprofit. And I didn't know that I could go online and look at the 990. That's wonderful, because my question is, in this situation, since they aren't giving out much information, how do I go about getting more on my own? And I can see that looking at the 990 is a great idea. Are there any other suggestions before I give them a chunk of change?
Great question, Jane. Appreciate the call. Let's ask both our guests. Denise St. Omer, any other suggestions for Jane where she can get more and more detailed information?
Well, I do think I would encourage you to look on our website to see if that's an organization that has voluntarily created an online profile, because I think that really can that's a good sign that there's transparency within that organization. You can also, as Amy referenced, you can look on GuideStar to see if it's a new or a small organization. They might not have a 990 on file yet, or they might be too small, small enough that they're not required to actually fill that out. And at that point, really, it becomes a little challenging if you want to remain anonymous, because I think the other thing that all donors can always do is contact the nonprofit directly and ask to see that information. And if they're not willing to share it with you, then that is, you know, a good sign.
It's a pretty good indicator, yeah.
It is.
Amy Costello, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I'd agree that, you know, a lack of transparency or people being unwilling to answer your, you know, pointed or specific questions is probably a red flag to consider. However, the one thing I will say is that I think a lack of a comprehensive website in the case that you're describing shouldn't necessarily mean a lack of integrity or impact on the part of the organization, because just like we were describing, do you want them to pay $100,000 to some, you know, designer to go build this great looking website, as many organizations do, or would you prefer them to be putting your donor dollars toward the project itself? So, you know, the lack of the website that you described could be a red flag, but it could be a promising sign that, in fact, they're all out busy in the community talking with the people that they want to help. You know, and it's also a good sign that you know some of the people. If you have any personal contacts to the people actually carrying out the initiative, I'd really encourage you to ask them all the questions that you have. If you really want to stay anonymous, have your friend go ask them. But I think it sounds like you have enough access to this initiative to start asking some of these questions yourself.
816-235-2888 is the number to call. George in Plattsburgh has a question.
I was interested in the program and enjoying it and went to the givewell.org website. The number one top charity that they have is Against Malaria Foundation, which seemed to be one that you thought was failing or not coming up to par. So I just wondered what your comment was on that.
I hear Amy chuckling there. And thank you, George, for the call. It sort of raises the point that different people may have different assessments of the effectiveness of organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've had some conversations with the folks over at GiveWell about this. You know, I don't think I have a lot more to add than the reporting that I've done, which anyone can listen to and which I've already described on your show. So I don't want to kind of wade through too much of it again. But, you know, and as I have said a couple times now, I think that bed nets are an important intervention. But what, you know, and I think I've also articulated what, in my opinion, based on my reporting, what needs to happen to make it a more effective intervention. There are significant challenges ahead for any organization relying on bed nets as a malaria prevention. But, you know, GiveWell, as I think you'll see, and I can't go through all the points right now off the top of my head, but I think they have a pretty thorough analysis of that organization. There's lots of organizations that are, behind distributing bed nets. But, you know, I guess I would encourage this listener, I think you make a very good point, and, you know, I think nothing in this industry is clear cut, and that's what makes it really interesting and fascinating to report. There are no black and white answers. Lots and lots and lots of gray. I've tried to sort through some of that gray. I've come to my own conclusions based on my own reporting, which you can listen to. GiveWell has come to theirs. I respect them as an organization and the interrogations that they do of nonprofits. So I guess I throw it back to you, the listeners, to kind of make that choice yourself.
Denise St. Omer, one of our callers a moment ago, described herself as cynical but generous. Do you think we need a healthy dose of cynicism as we think about our charitable giving? And how far should that go? I mean, is it okay to make some mistakes and give to some things because we mean well, even if we're not totally sure that it's all perfect?
Definitely. I always say is I think what where you start off as a donor is defining what it is you want to accomplish with your charitable giving. And so I think for all donors, you have to determine for yourself what level of risk you are comfortable with. So just like with if you are investing in your 401k, you decide how risky you want that investment to be. And I think it's also important that, particularly if you are, what you're doing is you're investing in a new promising organization or bringing in a new evidence-based program that matches up with your desires, there is some level of risk involved with that. And I think that is okay as long as Amy referenced earlier in the program, that a nonprofit is monitoring what they're doing, they're learning from the mistakes that they're making, and they're making program adjustments as they move forward.
Let's talk to Frank in Lawrence. Frank, good morning.
Yeah, briefly, I was in Somalia working with a refugee program there some years ago. There was a charity from England with a few women there who were buying some chickens from a woman next door for themselves, and they were concerned about using their money properly from the donors, and they were trying to bargain the woman down to get a lower price to help the donors basically use their money more properly. But they were concerned about whether by trying to bargain the woman down with a lower price, they were harming that woman's business abilities, and so they were in this dilemma of how to use the donors' money versus how to help the people they're working with.
Yeah, that's an interesting anecdote, Frank. I appreciate your sharing that. And Amy, thanks so much for calling. Amy Costello, these are complex questions, aren't they? The right way to use money is not always so easy to name.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that's one of the biggest challenges for this field, especially when working in nations far from our own, which is satisfying the requirements and wishes of donors here in the U.S. and you know, meeting the needs of the people on the ground in faraway places. You know, to me, it's a great sign that in some ways that these women were wrestling with this issue at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that shows, a goal of being fair and transparent and having integrity. At the same time, I think it's so difficult when you bring in lots of money to very, very poor places, and Somalia is certainly one of them. There's so many complexities, ways that nonprofit organizations are viewed by local populations as basically ones that have a lot of money, which is true. And it's very unfortunate historical legacy of our relationship as international donors to local communities. There's a lot of imbalance there, lots of problems that are longstanding and need to be rectified. But, you know, I think that there is a genuine ongoing struggle between the wishes of donors here in the U.S., how their money is being used, and the needs of the populations on the ground, not one that's easily solved or rectified.
I want to ask both of you in the short amount of time we have left about kind of the future of charitable giving. Has this been changing? Are you optimistic that this is actually getting easier to make sure that good intentions actually find good results? Denise St. Omer?
I think what we found at the Community Foundation, we have over 3,000 donor-advised funds, and our donors are really, I think they really are very educated. They want to make, they want to have the best impact they can with their dollars. And so I think what we've been finding is that they have really been looking, our donors have really been looking for and seeking out that information so that they can educate themselves and make great investments. And so, you know, we're really lucky here in Kansas City.
And Amy Costello, 20 seconds or so.
very optimistic about the future ahead. I think we're already seeing great strides being made to doing good more effectively and more transparently. And I think this disaster that happened in the Philippines is a wonderful example. I think we're really asking more critical questions before we dive in about what is the best way to use our donor dollars. That's very promising. I see lots of reasons to be optimistic. The way we give now is going to be very different than the way we give 10 years from now. I'm sure of it. All for the better.
I want to thank both our guests. That's Amy Costello of TinySpark.org and Denise St. Omer from the Greater Kansas City Community Foundation. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
We mentioned several websites during the broadcast today. Greater Kansas City Community Foundation is at gkccf.org. We also mentioned GiveWell, Charity Navigator, and GuideStar, all places you can get more information. You can find more information about all of our programs by going to the KCUR website in the Central Standard page. You can also download podcasts of all of our earlier broadcasts. Today's show was produced by Danny Alexander. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Ross Steinmetz and Sydney Llewellyn. Lori Arbor is our announcer. I'm Brian Ellison. This is KCUR.